Thank you. Thank you. I want to thank Maribel Roskay for inviting me here. I am in the chemistry department at Harvard University, and I think a lot about the interface of quantum information and chemical processes, from quantum simulation to quantum effects in nature and things of that sort. I've been funded by some of these people and for quantum computing. And, well, let me get started a little bit on why there is a chemist doing quantum computing here. And I forgot to tell you something. I apologize for just being here today, but this company funds me, and they are thinking a lot about the traveling salesman problem, and this has been my problem, the traveling scientist problem. So I apologize just being one day here. So in this paper, David Bacon, you know, was talking about what would be the beautiful use of quantum computers, right, if there was ever a quantum computer. And I like this paper a lot because use number two is cited as revolutionizing quantum chemical calculations. And yesterday I was taking beers with Peter Love, and he told me that you guys have been talking a lot about this connection of what is the goal of quantum chemistry and the new tools that have been discussed in this workshop. So I don't work in RDM, DMRG, or some of those things, but I work on the quantum computing side of things. How would a quantum computer help us do quantum chemistry? And in particular, my dream is kind of build things like this. You know, when the Greeks had mechanical power, to actually build gears and so on, they were able to build a mechanical simulator of the sky that is called the Antiki Kera, right? Which was found in the ocean, in the Greek Ocean. And so I guess 2,000 years ago we had classical technology and we were able to simulate classical motion. So I should remove here quantum, ancient mechanical simulator. So in the same vein, we might be able to build devices, and I know Peter was telling you yesterday about adiabatic devices, for example, that could be able to simulate physical systems, and that's kind of like the goal. And why are we interested in simulation in general? Because as Peter Galison, a very great historian of science, says, you know, if we didn't have simulation, we wouldn't have tokamak, fusion weapons, guidance systems, rockets, etc. Right? So computer simulation has enabled the 20th century and 21st century technologies. So now, what about the relationship of chemists to simulation? I just want to argue that we chemists have always been, trying to simulate molecules with whatever we can get. For example, as soon as automatic computers appeared, S.F. Boyce, which is probably the father of modern quantum chemistry, published this paper on the automatic fundamental calculation of molecular structure on the computers that he had at the time. Now, V. Ganesh in India made a quantum chemistry package for a cell phone. So if you have a Nokia N60, you can just download MobiMol, and then you can run the water molecule in your cell phone. I have an iPhone, but I want to get a Nokia N60. Well, so from that to, you know, supercomputers. So when I was a graduate student, I was slaving away at this molecule that took 250,000 hours of computer time with another method that I don't know if has been mentioned here, the quantum Monte Carlo method. And not surprisingly, chemistry and material sciences occupy most of the supercomputer time. So now, this is just a motivation, and I am Mexican, so I have to show you my Mexican tree of life, okay? So this is kind of how I see the evolution of algorithms for solving the electronic structure problem. You have beautiful flowers in some of the successes and a lot of skulls in the failures, okay? So that's kind of the Mexican tree of life. And this is kind of like how a classical computational chemist thinks about the electronic structure problem. I have another figure that I apologize, but I swear to you I have it, where it has RDM here coming out, right? Because, I mean, in reality, you know, all these RDM methods are a new branch. But you have density functional theory, you have exact simulation, and the idea here is that I think that we have to extend this tree, for example, to quantum computers as a little branch over here, a new little plant or a new branch. And the same for this other method. So we keep expanding this tree of quantum chemistry. Exact methods, like exact quantum Monte Carlo and full configuration interaction, have the following problem. That I don't want to wait until I die to be able to do two more atoms or three more atoms, right? The exact treatment of molecular systems scales exponentially with system size. And therefore, we can only treat a few atoms. All these polynomial methods are where most people are spending their attention, you know, trying to improve the scaling, and with linear scaling density functional theory, people are simulating already tens of thousands of atoms. So, but how about this, right? How about the exact treatment? That's where I want to go, right? Can a quantum computer help us? And then this is, of course, where Richard Feynman came, right? So Richard Feynman told us, well, you know, if I have a quantum physical system, I might be able to map the wave function of this molecule, for example, or this system that I want to simulate, to the wave function of the quantum mechanical system. And more crucially, if you find an appropriate mapping, and I will briefly summarize some of the mappings and ideas that we've been thinking about this, we need to actually map its time evolution operator. And I mean, this is basically the crux of the quantum computer simulation algorithm. How to efficiently implement this time evolution algorithm in such a way that the time evolution of this auxiliary quantum system is similar to the time evolution of your molecular system, or identical. And if so, if I have efficient algorithms for extracting properties, which I want to also tell you a little bit about, how to extract properties from these wave functions, then in principle I can go the path of quantum simulation, quantum simulation, or sometimes I like to call it quantum emulation, in which you basically use, instead of using your good old boring classical computer, you go directly to the quantum one. And here are some of the people that have been working on this. And of course it's a very partial list. So now this is a list of some of the things that we've been looking at since I started my lab and when I was a postdoc. So I will tell you in this order, first chemical dynamics, then full configuration interaction, and maybe, probably not, a little bit about, you know, random heteropolymer folding. We have a series of publications in which we try to advance this program of understanding what will be the steps to actually do molecular simulation. And why will a chemist be excited, of course? Because you can reduce the scaling from exponential that I showed you before to n to the 5 for the static problem. If you want to look at dynamic problems, and I will just explain to you why I'm calling this a static problem and this a dynamic problem, you get even a better scaling, and probably a quadratic scaling for optimization problems. So this is great compared to these horrible scalings here. So this is also exponential scaling, but it will get a quadratic speed up. So now let me tell you just the idea of chemical reaction dynamics. So this is kind of, you know, basically probably the simplest possible quantum simulation algorithm to think about, and it's actually very good, it has very good scaling. So the idea is the following. Let's think about a chemical reaction. Now let's think about, for example, H plus H2, which is the prototypical chemical reaction. Think about one of those things that executives like Madoff have in their office, like two little balls here, and then one ball comes here and comes back like this, right? Something like that is the H plus H2 problem. So you have an atom A that comes through this, reducing the distance RAB, and then kicks the atom C away and makes a new molecule AB, okay? So we chemists have been obsessed with that problem because it kind of is the simplest problem that we can think about. Here are the two distances, and this is a little simulation in MATLAB, of course, of the little wave packet that comes, crosses a barrier. So basically the wave packet comes over here, crosses this barrier, goes on the other side, and exits in a more complicated state than the one that came in. And this is the product state distribution, and what we're interested in is a quantum algorithm that actually helps us analyze this problem. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the steps of how one does this in a quantum device, okay? So one needs to actually figure out how to time evolve the system, okay? How to initialize the system, time evolve it, and measure observables. And I'll tell you a little bit about each one of those steps. Initialization is probably what, to me, is more connected to the subject of this workshop. We know that propagating in time in a quantum computer is efficient, but preparing molecular states, it has not shown to be efficient for all possible molecular states. As I will argue, I believe that most molecular states will be easy to prepare on a quantum computer, but it's not necessarily the case that all molecular states will be preparable. Because if that was the case, then we would be able to solve very hard computational problems. So state preparation is kind of one of the issues, and then observable measurements. Of course, we have to come up with efficient algorithms. And some of the things that chemists like to think about: reaction probabilities, rate constants, and state-to-state distributions. We have developed quantum algorithms to measure those things. So now this is basically the slide that tells you why propagation is not such an issue. Okay. So in this quantum algorithm, we choose to work in what is called the first quantization basis. So basically, we're thinking of real space. Okay. So if you think in real space, okay. You can think of time evolving your Hamiltonian that has a kinetic energy and a potential energy part, using standard Trotter or operator splitting technique. This is of course the lowest possible order. You can go to any order you want, in which you apply first the potential energy e to the minus iv times the time step, and then you go and apply the kinetic energy. And if you work in a spatial grid, okay, if you work just in a grid that contains x, y, and z dimensions, then the potential is a diagonal operator in position, and the kinetic energy is a diagonal operator in momentum space. So therefore, in a classical computer, many chemists, when they do these kind of simulations, what they do is they basically apply the potential operator, do a classical Fourier transform, then apply the kinetic energy, do its inverse, okay, or the inverse and then the Fourier transform, and then they repeat the iterations. So in a quantum computer, you do exactly the analogous thing. Okay, you prepare the quantum state, which is a subject that we'll touch back on later, and then you apply the potential and the kinetic energy, and in between you apply the efficient quantum Fourier transform and inverse quantum Fourier transform black boxes. So this is one of the only few black boxes that we know are efficient in quantum computers. So and then here we have a trick in our algorithm. In our paper, we improve upon the previous algorithms with a trick used for phase kickback I will not describe here. The idea is that if you use the state 1, it's an eigenstate of the quantum Fourier transform, and it saves you some grief. But anyway, the whole point here is that now the efficiency of this algorithm has to do with the efficiency of representing V and T. So is it efficient to actually evaluate the potential and the kinetic energy in a quantum computer? And if so, all the rest of the steps are efficient. So let's think about the potential and the kinetic energy in a second. But in the meantime, I intersperse this slide, okay, to start talking about the challenges. Okay, this is a paper by Andrew Steen, okay, which is one of the people that deal with ion traps, that inspires us to think that, okay, you know, this is more or less the type of system that we're talking about that will be necessary to simulate molecular systems. Every time we do our estimations, either in the time-dependent or the time-independent domain, we end up at about this order of magnitude of qubits, usually around 150, and more than gigaop of operations, actually, as you will see. Many operations will be required, okay? And of course, the problem is that if you encode these 300 logical qubits, you will actually require about 10,000 physical qubits. So what we're talking about really in this, as I call it, the science fiction quantum computer, or at least in this paper here, you will require about 10,000 atoms that implement error correction to do the things I'm telling you. But the reason I'm showing you the slide first is because I'll tell you some issues about the scaling. First, let's talk about the scaling of the mapping of a grid. Okay, so this quantum dynamics algorithm is a very simple algorithm. You have in each dimension for each particle, you have a grid, for example, of 1024 points per dimension. This is just an example that is reasonable looking at classical simulations of atoms. So if you were to have 1024 points per dimension, x, y, and z per particle, okay, that will be equivalent to having 10 qubits per particle, okay? So you would require 10 qubits to simulate, to store the wave function per dimension, so basically, 30 qubits per particle, okay? So if you actually look at that, then the number of qubits required to represent the wave function will appear in this axis for the following systems: the hydrogen molecule, the helium atom, lithium, oxygen, okay? And this purple line here is the science fiction quantum computer of Andrew Steen. Okay, so with that powerful quantum computer, let's say, we will be able to simulate the real-time electronic and nuclear dynamics of some system about this size. this is what we have found in the literature is what a classical supercomputer can do if you actually solve this brute force approach. So they said in a PRL paper that helium was great. They could simulate the attosecond electron dynamics of helium, but lithium was completely beyond reach of classical computers. So this kind of bounds more or less where this method could work. But notice that the scaling of this method is quadratic, and this goes back to the point of what is the efficiency of evaluating the kinetic energy and the potential. Turns out that this is one of those problems that you can only give to a first year graduate student, because second year graduate students will refuse to do. You know what I mean? This is the one where you need somebody with an infinite amount of motivation and a lot of patience. So what I told my students is, please figure out quantum algorithmic logic to evaluate the Coulomb potential. Okay? So figure out quantum division, quantum summation, how to do 1 over R on a, quantum. So basically the best tricks to do in reversible logic computing, algebra. Because you will really need to calculate to a certain degree of precision 1 over R for all particles. Okay? And that would be the black box. B is actually 1 over R, 1, 2, summated over all particles. It's the Coulomb interaction or the Lennard-Jones interaction. Okay? So Ivan went ahead and spent a lot of time doing this, and a couple of months later he came back with, a series of calculations that tells us the daunting challenge, okay? This is the number of gates per time step, okay? That you will require to actually simulate with the chemical precision that people would like to have, okay? 1 over R, 1, 2 is a very precise thing that you need to calculate to a certain degree of precision. I think we were talking about chemical precision here. So it was about something in the order of 20 or 30 digits of precision. So you needed to have ancillary registers to actually do all the little arithmetic and so on. And turns out that if you actually count that, all the number of gates that is advertised in the Andrew Steen quantum computer will only give you one time step, okay, for the oxygen atom. Okay, so it's a really challenging problem, and this is a problem that my group is working on, and that's what we're now interested in, adiabatic type approaches. If you really want to do chemical precision with a quantum computer, what we have found so far is the number of quantum gates is very large. Nevertheless, the algorithm is efficient. And why is it efficient again? Because computing the interaction between particles scales as the square of the system size. Okay, so now I'm just going to tell you an example of how can we think about simple quantum algorithms for measuring observables, for example, chemical reaction rates. So now, again, we're going back to our H plus H2 example. The little wave packet is coming here, crosses this barrier, and then here is the product, another H2 molecule. Okay? So again, the little Madoff executive thing. So you come here, and what you do is you need to have little black boxes in the quantum computer that tell you simple things, like, for example, execute this logic. If the number Y is less than X, then do something, and if the number Y is greater or equal than X, then something else. So what that does, is actually flipping a face. Okay, so you can actually create a little black box that figures out if you have a wave packet on the left or a wave packet on the right of this line here. Okay, and this is an example of how, for example, one can get transition probabilities. There are fancier things you can do. You can do Fourier transforms on these wave packets that come out to figure out, what vibrational state the molecule comes out and so on. But the idea is that what you can usually measure in the quantum computer are simple observables like the energy, like the transition probabilities, or anything that you can store in a number, right? As you guys probably know, you cannot get the wave function out. That will be equivalent to quantum state tomography, and that, as you know, is exponentially hard. So we cannot get the wave function directly, but of course we can get expectation values or observables. Okay. So now let me just move on to the time-independent algorithm, which is another type of algorithm. They are both equivalent in a sense, but now I'm going to think about in second quantization, which is the language in which now I'm thinking about what we call Fock space or occupation space, a space in which now we're thinking about orbitals. So here we have, for example, a simple molecule that contains 5 orbitals, and we're going to form later determinants of those orbitals. Okay? So this is, for example, what is called the Hartree-Fock determinant. It's a determinant made of the lowest energy states okay, of the mean field calculation. So here we have simple ground state. And then if you actually build, you know, 2k choose n configurations, okay, what we call configurations, which are basically determinants in which now you have electronic excitations, okay, and you have determinants that have single excitations, double excitations, triple excitations, you end up with a huge humongous matrix that you cannot even build in a classical computer efficiently, yet then diagonalized, right, because it's very large. So this is kind of like the exact problem that I was showing you in the line, in the flat line, in the scaling plots. And if you just write a little bit of notation, then the idea is that you have a linear wave function. Quantum computers are great for linear problems like this one, okay? You have just this linear wave function expansion over this reference or Hartree-Fock mean field wave function, single excitations, double excitations, triple excitations, and then you end up building this huge matrix, right? So in a quantum computer, what you want to do is not build this matrix, but use some of those tricks that I was telling you before of time splitting or you know, chopping up the Hamiltonian in pieces. So how does a computer solve this problem? If you look in the second quantized basis, this is the molecular Hamiltonian. So let me explain what this is. This is basically orbitals, molecular orbitals p and q, and these are single particle operators, the kinetic energy and the electronuclear potential. So electrons have their own kinetic energy, they are attracted to the nuclei in a certain way, and because of this, of that, this is an amplitude of jumping from one of these orbitals to another orbital due to those single particle objects, okay? So that's basically the probability that an electron, due to its kinetic energy, jumps, let's say, to an excited state orbital or comes down, etc. So these are fluctuations in the orbital space. These are actually, you know, the hard ones, this is, you know, correlation. This tells you if an electron is in orbital S and an electron is in orbital R, then their interaction energy will make them scatter to orbitals Q and P with the probability given by this integral, and, you know, just basically this is the Hopping operator, right? So this is a Hamiltonian that contains n to the 4 of these terms and n squared of these terms. So the trick for making this work in a quantum computer is to actually execute these terms one by one in a throttle splitting way, the same way that we split in the kinetic and potential energy before, but now we're splitting in this second quantization space. So you start with one of these terms, then apply the other one, then apply the other one for a very small time step, iterate again for the next time step, and move on and move on and move on. There is a caveat though that quantum computers are made of distinguishable spin 1/2 particles. So you have to actually transform these fermionic operators to the spin 1/2 particle operators. And that is achieved by a Jordan-Wigner transformation. Okay? So that is also something that sometimes one has to worry about in for example, other approaches, like the MRG or something, right? These kind of mappings. But for us, you know, this gives you an extra n scaling. This mapping is scales as the order of n of the system. So this whole algorithm scales as n to the 5, n to the 4 for these terms, times an order of n that comes from this Jordan-Wigner transformation. So there are a few gates required by each term, but this is still a daunting amount of terms. So now this is basically the quantum algorithm as it looks for this problem. You have a wave function now represented in second quantization, so now you have orbitals instead of a grid in space. That's much more efficient. And then what you do is you do its time evolution and entangle it with a qubit. Then two times that time evolution and you entangle it with a second qubit. And then 4 and 8. This is kind of like the usual thing that one does, for example, for factoring numbers. What you want to get is the periodicity or the phase, the time evolving phase of this evolution operator. That I'm calling here V because we have a recursive trick of getting one bit at a time that is not so important. But the idea here is that you get, in a way, you get time evolution that is Fourier transformed into frequencies. And these frequencies are mounted in a phase that I can read with a quantum computer, with an algorithm called phase estimation. So the idea is that the problem is, for quantum computer simulation, this is another hidden thing under the carpet, is that every additional bit that you want will cost you twice the amount of number of gates. So therefore, there is an exponential scaling hidden in the quantum simulation algorithm. You cannot go beyond a certain precision in a quantum computer because you end up finding an exponential wall. And this has to do with quantum metrology. You know, you cannot just measure a phase faster than this. Okay? So that's another one of the limitations that we have in quantum computer simulation. Luckily, for molecular systems, you only need about 20 bits of precision. So now, how will this scale on a computer of this type? Here is the number of spatial basis functions for a given set of molecules, and here is the number of qubits that they are mapped to. So these intelligence types say that a computer about this size will be very useful for cracking passwords. It's about the same size to simulate a molecule very close to my heart, cholesterol. So, you know, cholesterol would require more or less the same amount of computer time than cracking a password on the internet or something. Okay? So that's great. But then another enthusiastic and now, depressed graduate student, right? James Whitfield. And of course he moved on to less detailed projects, I guess, now. But he did the same exercise as Ivan. I wanted to know how many qubit operations would you require to simulate, again, cholesterol, the molecule dear to my heart. And for a given single time step, you require about 10 to the 15 two qubit operations. Okay? So again, this is the daunting thing. So one of my colleagues this is a slide from one of my colleagues at Georgia Tech, Ken Brown. Another Ken is doing quantum computing. Okay? And what Ken Brown did, he said, well, look, he is aware of this problem, and he said, what about error correction? How long would this take in a real, realistic quantum computer? Okay? So Ken has been working on something that is called quantum architectures with Isaac Chuang. The field of quantum architecture is, let's not only think about a quantum computer, let's think about how to build it, right? Let's think about quantum dots, let's think about ions and so on, and think about what is the necessary physical arrangement of these ions, the times necessary to do operations, all the possible physical parameters that you can think of to actually implement error correction algorithms. So there's they have a model called the quantum logic array model, Isaac Chuang, published in this journal that I never opened, Micro. Okay, but the idea here is that Ken used that model to figure out for our problem of quantum chemistry simulation. He actually was doing something simpler, the Ising model in the transverse magnetic field, but the ideas are exactly the same. What will it take you to actually do error correction? So solo by key type kind of problems in which you have a finite gate set that only gives you a certain amount of precision. On top of that, you have the throttled error, and you have to do quantum error correction on top of that. And now this is an example of 100 spins for this model. So this is 100 days of actual computation on that quantum logic array model, okay? So a realistic quantum computer. So if you wanted to simulate 100 particles, it would take you a lot of time. If you actually were doing no error correction, it would take you way less. But if you actually do kind of cheap error correction, you are beyond 100 days. And if you actually do, level 3 error correction, you are already, and this is, of course, a logarithmic scale, right? So you're already very far away, okay? So this is kind of like the state of the art of the field. And I don't want to be pessimistic. Now I'm going to try to be optimistic in the remainder of the talk. This paper has been in review for a long time. We recently started working to try to do the first possible experiments. So Andrew White and Ben Langeon at Australia and Marco Delmeida, Geoff Gillett, and others were working with my students. These are the two students I was mentioning before, James and Ivan, and also Alejandro, Masud, etc. in my lab, to actually try to carry out the first quantum experiment, okay? So can we actually do things, right? So the first experiment that was able to be done is something like this. So you have Dirac here, the bound and the unbound state of the hydrogen molecule. He can do it here in the blackboard. And here it is, a 2x2 quantum system, okay? So you have basically just two orbitals, occupied and unoccupied orbitals. And this is the MATLAB solution to that problem. And this is the quantum computer solution, okay? So this is actually what's done in the quantum optics setup of Andrew White to 22 bits of precision. You see the experimental errors, experimental numbers are exactly on top of the actual digital numbers because the quantum computer is a digital object. So I'm very happy about this because it shows people that although we have this daunting scaling ahead of us, we actually have already experiments. So how those experiments look like? You have a single parametric down conversion setup that generates entangled photons. And this is kind of like the simplest possible way of doing the experiment. You have a single qubit that reads out the energy. That's the thing that actually, this is kind of like our simplest possible way of doing the quantum Fourier transform, one qubit at a time. Okay? And then here we have the time evolution of the quantum system as a single one qubit, controlled one qubit evolution here. So what we really did using Andrew White's technology is the ability to be able to do this controlled unitary evolution of this particular target register with a lot of precision in an object that looks like this. Okay? So this was all automated. They actually moved the stages, the little weight plates and so on. And I'm not an experimental, so I apologize if you ask me, you know, hard questions about this. But basically, this is the actual setup that computed those numbers. So turns out that for the hydrogen molecule, you have a bunch of 2x2 problems in a 6x6 space. So you can diagonalize them all. And here we have, for example, the ground state and the excited states of the hydrogen molecule. And this is kind of like the number of experiments that you need to do for majority voting. Here we can do a very simple error correction technique to figure out what is one bit for this guy, and then another bit for this guy, and so on. So they tell me that each one of these points takes about 2 minutes on this prototypical early quantum computer. Okay? So that's just an example of the kind of things that where we are right now. Now, I told you I was gonna come back a little bit to state preparation, and I only have like 4 slides on it, but we recently have a long paper in JCP, actually 2009, just came out a couple months ago, in which we actually go through the details of state preparation. I'll tell you what we discovered. First of all, we discovered that state preparation has been rediscovered in the field of quantum computing many, many, many times. So at least in our paper, we tell you, okay, this person did this, this person did this, this person rediscovered this, and that again is the patient of an undergraduate student in my lab, Nicholas Ward, that still has patients and work with Ivan, figuring out all the different connections between everybody. But the idea is something like this. What you want to do is, in a grid, for example, I'm going to tell you now state preparation in a grid. You want to start with a little state that is uniformly distributed, so you can prepare a uniform superposition, and then you kind of you can telescopically prepare a distribution. Okay, so the idea is the following: if I have a distribution, I can divide the distribution, for example, in left and right of around the center. Okay, so for example, left will be 0 and right will be 1. The next qubit will actually give me the next level of resolution, and I will have now the 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1 state, and so on. Right. So the idea is converting a uniform distribution in, for example, something integrable, like let's say a Gaussian. So the idea here is that you actually have to compute in the quantum computer integrals, okay, of the function. Here we are actually worrying only about the square of the function. Turns out that you can actually introduce phases easily. But the idea here is that you have to be, the complexity, and this is where I want to go, of preparing arbitrary states on a quantum computer has to do with the complexity of being able to integrate them, okay? So the idea is that you actually calculate this integral and then rotate the qubits accordingly, rotate your first qubit accordingly to how much of the function is on the left and how much of the function is on the right, and then you move on to the next level of resolution, and you do this over and over again, okay? So that's what you can do to prepare a single particle state. And as I tell you, there's a slew of papers. For example, this paper by Alexei Kitaev, a very famous quantum computing person, was done with his undergraduate web, how to prepare Gaussians, for example, okay? So in our case, you also have to worry about the second problem. The first quantized wave function is actually not anti-symmetrized, okay? So the idea here is that now you have actually the occupation numbers in the second quantized, and the first quantized representation will be the spatial representation that I told you how to prepare. So what you now want to think about is how to anti-symmetrize. And it turns out that anti-symmetrization is not not so easy to do on a quantum computer, but it's possible. The hero here was Seth Lloyd. So Seth Lloyd figured out how to do it. And again, Nicholas and Ivan improved a little bit on the algorithm. But there is a way of anti-symmetrizing states. So you end up with an anti-symmetric state that contains either all the positive or all the negative permutations. And that's of course essential for simulating other bosons. If you want to simulate, you know, if you want to simulate everything that is completely symmetric, or if you want to simulate something completely anti-symmetric, then you have to do, the same algorithm, just changing signs a little bit differently. Now, Peter told me that yesterday he was telling you about adiabatic computing. Another approach for preparing molecular states is to actually start with a mean field solution and slowly correlate it in the quantum computer. Okay, so that's what we call adiabatic state preparation. Inspired by these adiabatic quantum computing methods, what you do is you time evolve the wave function slowly enough in such a way that you mutate your Hamiltonian from the uncorrelated Hamiltonian to the correlated one. And this will work if there are some conditions. For example, the conditions are that you do it slower than 1 over the gap squared, and this is kind of like the simplest possible condition. Now people know there are better adiabatic conditions. But basically, if the gap of the system is very small, then you will have to do adiabatic preparation for a very long time. So our argument, okay, we don't have a proof about this, and it would be great to have a proof, is that most molecular insulators, and this is a discussion I have with Peter Love a lot, most molecular insulators will be fine, right? Or molecules that are not in next to crossings of electronic states, okay? So if you have an easy chemical problem, like a ground state problem, in which there is no, for example, energy level crossing or things like that, then what we have seen numerically is that the gap of the problem as you do the adiabatic state preparation, it only interpolates between the mean field gap and the correlated gap with no big surprise. Okay, so as you correlate a system, the gap doesn't do anything crazy. This is just numerical, and we have a conjecture about it, but of course, this is the crux of the problem, because if you ask me, can you prepare a metal in a quantum computer? I will probably tell you I don't think so, okay? Because, you know, if I really want to distinguish between the electronic levels of something that is very degenerate, okay, I will probably get bands as well. I won't be able to actually do something very precise, okay? So the point is, adiabatic state preparation is a problem, okay? Not a problem, but in the sense that, you know, if you do numerics, for example, here we have the hydrogen molecule. This is what I was just trying to tell you. This is the overlap with the ground state for different molecular separations, and we can arbitrarily pump up the overlap with the ground state and actually prepare the system that we want with gaps that do not do anything crazy as we do the adiabatic state preparation. So that happens for a molecule that is well-behaved, but how do you know that this will fail for larger molecules? Well, if you know that, for example, my shirt is a polymer and it has a certain color, that means that the gap of this polymer is more or less constant, even if the polymer is very long. So that tells you that insulators, like my shirt, will probably have a amenable preparation. And conductors might not be very easy in a quantum computer. So I have I have time. Perfect. So let me tell you I'm in time, so let me just tell you the last thing that we did, that we've been thinking about. So we've been thinking about the next problem, which will be, how can you do other things in a quantum computer? For example, properties. What we really would like to know, for example, is the derivative of the energy, you know, with respect to electric fields, okay? For example, to get dipoles or polarizabilities or hyperpolarizabilities, okay? So those are very important molecular properties that you can basically associate with a perturbative expansion in the molecular energy, okay? So these coefficients in quantum chemistry are called the molecular properties. So a good question is, can I use a quantum computer to get these beasts, right? Because they will be very useful for chemists. Actually, chemists would like mostly the derivative of the energy with respect to nuclear coordinates to be able to optimize molecular geometries on a quantum computer. So it turns out that one of our colleagues at MIT has an algorithm called Stephen Jordan was a graduate student at MIT. He published a very, very nice paper on how to evaluate gradients on quantum computers. So the way to evaluate a gradient is kind of interesting. What you do is you do the similar trick that I was telling you before for quantum simulation, preparing an eigenstate of the quantum Fourier transform here, sorry, of the sum operator here. This is you can show that with a single evaluation of the function followed by a Fourier transform, okay, on a superposition of a bunch of points, okay, so let me explain. The idea is that we want to do finite difference in a quantum computer. So you create a superposition of not only two points, a forward and a backward point, but all the possible points in a line. In quantum computer, it costs you the same. And then you do finite difference on it, okay? So you do finite difference in superposition, and turns out that you can get a state that contains the gradient. Okay? And the advantage of this algorithm is that no matter the dimensionality of the problem, if it's a 1D, 2D, 3D, 4D problem, you will require the same number of function evaluations because you did things in parallel. So you need to evaluate the wave the function once, and you will get its gradient. Okay? So what was our contribution then? We, for example, came up after Steven and figured out how to, for example, evaluate the gradient at different positions. You just have to do some shift, do the same thing, and then now you can get gradients at different positions. And this is an important black box because we're going to use this black box of getting the gradient at different positions, okay, to now construct the second derivative black box. Okay, so now we can construct second derivatives, third derivatives, fourth derivatives, etc., by recursively applying his algorithm. And of course, the details are not important. What is interesting is that you need the following scaling. You need now two evaluations of the function for the second derivative, okay? Four evaluations for the third derivative, okay? And so on. So you have an exponential scaling in the number of derivatives, in the number of function evaluations. But usually chemists only care about first, second, and third derivatives or so. So you only need eight function evaluations regardless of the dimensionality of the problem. So this is a huge advantage for quantum chemistry in the sense that you don't worry about dimensionality anymore, and you have more or less the numerical precision of a very good numerical differentiation. So we've been worrying a lot about if your molecular landscape is very rough, what will happen? And what we basically just say that if you can assume that there is a numerical derivative available, then this thing will work fine. Okay, so that's kind of like the bottom line here. Okay. So the reason why we need two evaluations of the function is that in quantum computers you need to uncompute functions. If you compute a function and you don't want to mess up your faces, you need to uncompute it. Okay? So if you want to do a Hessian, okay, you will need to uncompute gradients. And then if you want to do the next derivative, then you will need to uncompute it as well. Okay? So for each n derivative, I need 2 to the n minus 1 function evaluations. So again, quantum computers usually have also the same exponential speedups hidden somewhere. In this case, if you want to get a 20th derivative, then you need a lot of work, okay? But if you want to get just the second or third derivative, then you're fine. So this is just a paper that we are submitting this week. How much time do I have? 3 minutes. Okay, so I guess I should end here and not make a mess about protein folding. The only thing I want to tell you, maybe if I have a couple of minutes, is that you can also think of other problems in which quantum computers will be useful for chemistry. And what we've been thinking about is how to map these lattice, protein lattice models to what an adiabatic quantum computer looks like, which is basically a quantum Ising type model, okay? So you have spins in a lattice that can be either up or down. And the question is that you can map this classical problem into this classical problem with some polynomial overhead. And therefore, from that polynomial overhead, then one will actually be able to solve this problem using an adiabatic quantum computer. Okay? So we have a way of, for example, mapping the simplest possible protein model that looks like this. Okay? It's basically a little self-avoiding walk in a 2D lattice in which every time you have two of these red hydrophobic amino acids, these are the guys that like to be in the center of the protein, you lower the energy, and then these hydrophilic ones are in the outside. So the idea here is that as you actually build up the complexity of this model, this thing actually starts folding like a protein and have more or less similar landscapes and so on. So we are kind of exploring how, for example, a quantum computer will, starting from an equal superposition of four protein configurations, will actually end up in a particular one. So, I mean, just to conclude, this is more or less, I just wanted to give you an overview of more or less where the state of the art is in this quantum computer simulation. We have very simple experiments. We're looking, trying to solve this problem of time evolution, okay? How can you time evolve with less and less number of gates? For that, now we're thinking more of hybrid quantum simulators in which you have something more analogic, in which you have some static device that time evolves due to fixed interactions, and then you have some time-dependent device that actually can read its energy using, for example, phase estimation. So some hybrid between adiabatic quantum computing and regular quantum computing gate model is what we think is necessary to be able to simulate without these daunting gate costs. But at least now we have these daunting gate costs. Nevertheless, even if the gate costs look daunting right now, these algorithms are efficient for the exact quantum chemistry problem. And of course, there are many other connections in which quantum information has been helping physical chemistry, for example, in the analysis of photosynthetic energy transfer. So I'm very happy about the fact that quantum information scientists are meeting more and more chemists, and we are talking to each other and trying to solve problems in many, many areas. So with that, I just want to stop my talk now and answer questions.